طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This week we begin with a fact-based report on the influence of money on our political system. That, of course, is not exactly news. Phil Weiss of Mondo Weiss has written a troubling article documenting the power of the Jewish community in using its funding to control members of Congress concerning their votes on the flow of money to support Israel. Recent events give illustration to this phenomenon. Here is Phil Weiss's report, and I quote from his article. There's been a lot of consternation among Palestine advocates over the political roller coaster ride in Congress. First, in an unprecedented show of power, pro-Palestinian members of Congress managed to stop the Democratic House leadership from slipping $1 billion of military funding to Israel's Iron Dome program into a bill to fund the government. So the Democratic leadership asked for names. It called for an up-and-down vote on Iron Dome funding, and pro-Palestinian politicians were crushed, 420-9. In the end, even New York's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, failed to vote against, voting present, and said that the bill was a reckless effort to rip our communities apart. Critics of Israel, such as Betty McCollum and Mark Pocan and Jamal Bowman, fell away and voted for $1 billion on top of the $3.8 billion we already give Israel every year, a 26% increase in security assistance to Israel. That $1 billion is more than twice what this country spends on either NATO or the Peace Corps. That $1 billion is going to a country that has a higher per capita GDP than France, Japan, and the United Kingdom. A country that has been described as an apartheid state by Human Rights Watch. In the course of 2 days, the mood within the pro-Israel community went from histrionic alarm to celebratory glee, whereas the other side traveled the same path in reverse. To understand the politics of this failure, you need to take AOC's explanation at its word. It created a real sense of panic and horror among those in our community who otherwise engaged thoughtfully in these discussions. AOC was saying the Jewish community is upset that we might stop this funding, but people of color are largely opposed to the funding. The New York Times conveyed the same message when it wrote that Iron Dome opposition came from a new generation of progressive Democrats, many of them people of color. The organized Jewish community was all for this funding. There are 28 Jews in the House, 26 of them Democrat. All 28 voted for these funds. All the mainstream Jewish organizations were lobbying for it. The unanimity of the Jewish Congress people underlines a widespread political understanding. Jews are for Israel. 95% of American Jews support Israel. 85% of openly Jewish college Jews are strongly supportive of Israel, says this recent survey of supposed campus anti-Semitism. The left-wing group's Jewish Voice for Peace and If Not Now surely represent the new wave in Jewish life, and they opposed the funding. Those groups apparently gave Representative Ayanna Pressley of Boston a reason to vote against the funding. If you reach that conclusion that American Jews are for military aid to Israel, it's very hard to oppose that aid as a Democrat, because Jews are so important to the Democratic Party. Jews vote Democratic at about 3-1, nearly as reliably as African Americans. Their turnout rates are very high, and they are a key voting bloc in a few states, notably Florida, New Jersey, and New York, and they are important in a dozen or more congressional districts from California to Illinois to Michigan to Virginia. It's obviously not just voting. Jews are far and away the wealthiest group by religion in our society. 44% of households made over $100,000 in 2016, well above the national average of 19%. Democrats get half their campaign funding from Jewish sources, a leading Israeli advocate said in 1996. The role of Jewish Democratic donors is gigantic and shocking, two experts told J Street in 2016. J.J. Goldberg of The Forward and Stephanie Shriok, then the head of Emily's List, respectively. The New York Times called Jewish donors the elephant in the room in 2019. Of the dozens of personal checks greater than $500,000 made out to the largest PAC for Democrats in 2018, the Senate Majority PAC, around three-fourths, were written by Jewish donors. This arithmetic was true 50 years ago. Jews contributed as much as 75% of what Hubert Humphrey spent running for president in 1968 and 1977, and constituted more than 60% of the large donors to the Democratic Party. It was true in Obama's era. When Obama ran for Senate in 2004, his financial backers included Chicagoans Lester Crown, several members of the Pritzker family, owners of the Hyatt hotel chain, and another neighbor, Alan Solow, later head of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. All were major financial backers of Israel, Rashid Holiday wrote in his book, Brokers of the Seed. When Obama tangled with Benjamin Netanyahu over settlements in 2011, his aide, Ben Rhodes, said that he was given a list of leading Jewish donors to call to reassure them of Obama's pro-Israel bona fides. What Carter did not fully understand was that support for any incumbent Israeli government was the ultimate litmus test of Jewish identity for mainstream Jewish leaders. It remained so, even when sorely tried by Israeli politicians. This influence is why a leading Israeli lobbyist once bragged to a reporter, Jeffrey Goldberg, who himself once served in the Israeli army, that he could get the signatures of 76 senators on a napkin by the next morning. Congressional Democrats are well aware of these forces. Recall that when Ralph Warnock walked back criticisms of Israel in his close Senate race in Georgia last year, he won the backing of the Democratic Majority for Israel, DMFI, and won the race. By contrast, last summer, Democratic Majority for Israel and other pro-Israel PACs poured more than $2 million in negative TV ads against Nina Turner's race against a Democratic establishment candidate in an Ohio congressional district after Turner refused to meet Israel lobbyists' demands that she renounce the squad. Those ads are never mentioned in Israel. The lobby doesn't want that issue publicized. But Turner was clobbered in Jewish areas of Cleveland suburbs, and Democratic Majority for Israel has been bragging about Turner's defeat ever since. Jamal Bowman, whose district includes a lot of southern Westchester, was surely thinking of Nina Turner's loss when he voted for the Iron Dome funding. Joe Biden wants to do nothing to alienate the Jewish war chest right-wing Israel lobby in his efforts to hold the Congress and the White House for Democrats. Nancy Pelosi feels the same way. If this Capitol crumbled to the ground, the one thing that would remain would be our commitment to our aid. I don't even call it our aid, our cooperation with Israel, she said 2 years ago. This commitment by Democratic leadership is so strong that Palestinians don't get access to congressional offices without the endorsement of liberal Zionist groups. While right-wing Zionists continue to dominate the Jewish discourse, David Harris of the American Jewish Committee said that legislators who tried to stop Iron Dome were seeking Israel's end. Harris was echoing Ted Deutch's hateful rant against Rashida Tlaib on the House floor. Deutch called Tlaib, who is Palestinian, an anti-Semite because she, quote, besmirched our ally by using the word apartheid to describe Israel. I cannot allow any one of my colleagues to stand on the floor of the House of Representatives to label the Jewish Democratic State of Israel an apartheid state. I reject it. I say to my colleague who just besmirched our ally, we can have an opportunity to debate a lot of issues on the House floor, but to falsely characterize Israel is consistent with those who advocate for the dismantling of the one Jewish state in the world. When there's no place on the map for one Jewish state, that's anti-Semitism. Deutsch's powerful speech was applauded by the Democratic Majority for Israel. But the world's leading human rights groups have said just that about Israel. It's an apartheid state. And as Beth Miller of Jewish Voice for Peace points out, there is no support for Tlaib from her fellows under Deutsch's hideous attack. That's the role of the Israeli lobby, to stand by Israeli governments no matter how right-wing, to call on American Jews to support the one and only Jewish state, and to vilify anyone who stands up for Palestinian human rights as an anti-Semite. Part of the tragedy is that our media have accepted the view that it is anti-Semitic to discuss the role of the organized Jewish community because it's a discussion of Jewish power. After the vote, the New York Times congressional correspondent observed that even outspoken progressives were caught between their principles and the still powerful pro-Israel voices in their party, such as influential lobbyists and rabbis. But after those same pro-Israel voices said this language was anti-Semitic, the paper removed the words. The good news is that 9 congresspeople decided to stand up against it. And the Israeli lobby hears footsteps. As one lobbyist wrote in the New York Times, quote, "The debate over the Iron Dome system represents a tectonic shift in the discourse among Democrats, one that is likely to shape U.S.-Israel relations for decades," unquote. That was an article written by Phil Weiss in Mondo Weiss. And now on to our feature presentation this week, which is a speech by journalist Ian Williams, delivered at a forum sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, which picks up on our examination of the influences of the Israeli lobby on global politics. We begin with the introduction of Ian Williams.
And now we're going to move, I guess, sort of from Washington to New York with Ian Williams, as we kind of discussed U.S. policy and the Israel lobby at the U.N. Ian has been on the U.N. beat for a very long time for us here at the Washington Report. He's our U.N. columnist, and he's also the president of the Foreign Press Association and the author of a few books. Sorry, as the police go by. Including this book right here, Untold, The Real Story of the United Nations in Peace and War, available from our bookstore. Today he'll be discussing bipartisan support for Israel at the UN under both Democratic and Republican administrations, and offer some insights into perhaps how this will change or continue under the Biden administration. So with that, Ian, we're very excited to have you and look forward to your remarks.
Well, change, inshallah, as they say, in that part of the world. There's several things. I'm really glad I didn't do a prepared speech because I don't want to repeat what other people have done here. And there's a lot of stuff that feeds in to what we have to say about the UN. And even as we were speaking, one of the issues that came up was the influence of the lobby on, it's not just on the Middle East, it's the entire US foreign policy has been put in question by this slavish support for Israel. You can't support Israel in this sense of slavish support and support the United Nations Charter. So in effect, support of Israel involves repudiating the 1945 UN Charter that FDR and the US fought so hard for. It means challenging the whole role of international law, of humanitarian order. There's no way that the US can go to the Serbs and say, you can't treat Kosovars like that. Well, they can do, but they can't do it with a straight face when they're countenancing what's happening in the occupied territories. You can't go to Syria and say, you can't blow up people like that. It's against humanitarian law, but it's okay for our allies to use white phosphorus. You can't say it's okay for Saudi Arabia to put journalists through meat grinders and then turn around and say, but look what those Iranians are doing. It detracts from the whole point of a principled foreign policy. And each time this comes up, US foreign policy towards Turkey, is it based on whether Erdogan is a good guy or a bad guy at any given moment? No, it's based upon whether Erdogan and the Turks are sympathetic to Israel or not. Right down the line, this comes up. And we've had several egregious examples recently, in particular over Kosovo. Now, I supported independence for Kosovo in the columns of the Washington Report. I actually pointed out that the apartheid declaration applied to how the Serbs treated the Kosovars. It was quite explicit. So we support them, but then we get this deal between Serbia and Kosovo in return for them both accepting Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. So it's not due on the inherent merits of whether Kosovo deserves to be independent or not, or whether Serbia should be forced to make peace with some American pressure. It's what Israel wants, get it? Western Sahara, another issue which we've dealt with in the columns of the Washington Report for many years. I don't know what a legal effect. I think that Trump's declaration, I don't think a tweet by a deranged exiting president really counts as remaking foreign policy or international law. But his recognition, so-called, that Morocco is the titular owner of Western Sahara has no validity in international law. I don't think the State Department echoed it. I don't think they've declared on it. And one of the tests for Biden's independence will be whether he says, no, that's not true. That's an occupied territory by UN declarations and resolutions that we, the US, have supported. Western Sahara is occupied. But because Morocco has toadied up to Israel, and we come back to the key point in our international politics from the US, is that the road to Washington goes through Israel for almost every country. How they vote at the UN in regards to Israel means that they think that they will get a sympathetic hearing and the Israel lobby behind them. So it has completely deleterious effects. Morocco, because it's been a quasi, it's opposed Israeli policies on paper and supported them, in fact, for many decades now. And it's done so because that's the way it gets support in Washington. Turkey, for many years, supported Israel because that's the way it got support in Washington. Now Turkey doesn't feel it needs support from Washington because it can get weapons from Russia. And it's giving the finger to everybody concerned on this. But it's not a good way to think out a joined-up foreign policy. And we come to South Africa, a key point. I have to confess, I started writing a book on the Israel lobby many years ago, which I wish I'd completed. Things happened, but I did a lot of research for it. And one of the things that intrigued me was how did the Congressional Black Caucus allow that Israel could be the major conduit for weapons into South Africa and for diamonds out of South Africa. So while we're calling for a boycott of South Africa, we're keeping the tap open in Israel. And I asked this question to Rabbi Arthur Herzberg at NYU just before. I said, how did you manage to keep the Congressional Black Caucus in hand? Why weren't they calling for a boycott of Israel as part of the boycott of South Africa? And he looked at me and he was very astute. He said, you know, you're very clever. I negotiated the treaty with the Congressional Black Caucus. And the deal was that we would support them on all the domestic issues as long as they didn't raise the question of Israeli ties to apartheid. And that deal held. That deal held. It's far tighter than the NATO treaty. It held until very recently. So, you know, our support, all ethics out the window, because it's expedient for one country. And it comes over and over again in the case of the United Nations. And let's remember about the United Nations. The US set up the United Nations. It was FDR's creation. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights was written by his wife, pretty much. Well, she got a lot of support. I think her work's been overblown on it. But Resolution 181 of the UN in 1947, which marked the foundation of the State of Israel. It's the legitimization. This is not Moses' tablets coming down from Mount Sinai, but the Resolution 181 is the title deed of the Zionists to Israel. There's no other document. And with the Balfour Declaration, one eccentric civil servant writing a memo to try and get support during World War I does not constitute a legitimate international transfer of, I think it was Monty Python, you know, watery bins waving swords from underwater is not a legitimate instrument of transfer of power. So the Balfour Declaration isn't. 181 is. And by the way, we tend to forget that Stalin and the Soviet Union were eager proponents of the foundation of Israel. But even then, I mean, I know from my researches at the UN, the Jewish Telegraph Agency was acting as a de facto pre-Israel embassy. They lobbied members. all the members of the United Nations were getting lobbied to support that resolution intensely. Huge pressure. We know they put pressure on Truman as well. But there's that been war, that war of attrition has carried on since then. And I'd sort of race forward, because the one thing that the famous resolution, which is spoken with such horror and disdain, is the resolution in 1975, which declared Zionism a form of racism and racial discrimination. It was finally repealed in December 16th, 1991, and I was in the General Assembly when it happened. And let's remember the circumstances. We're talking expediency here. This was all, like one of those town councils in the Midwest that passes a resolution saying that from now on, pi is equal to 3. Because it was quite clear to all of the delegates that Zionism was a form of racism and racial discrimination. But not many delegates were going to get up to a US that had just pulverized Iraq and say so. I can tell you. George W. Bush wanted this resolution. Why? It was appeasement for the fact he had the temerity to stand up. He and Bob Dole had the temerity to stand up against Israel on the question of the loan guarantees. He'd actually held them down on that one. He'd faced them off. But then he met such a storm of assaults from the lobby, he thought he'd buy them off with this. It didn't work. They still hated him. They took it and ran. And it was repealed. I remember the circumstances. The president of the General Assembly was actually the Saudi ambassador. And he took a walk. It's what they call the toilet vote in the UN, in the UN, the restroom vote. He went out and made sure that somebody else stood in his place because he wasn't going to be presiding over this vote. Israel afterwards got itself invited to join the West European and other group under heavy US pressure. This meant it was a regional group. It's in rotation for the Security Council. Unfortunately for Israel, the West European and other group actually has real elections. It has people standing against each other instead of going on a rota system. So I have to say that whatever they do, Israel is very, very unlikely to get elected because it goes to the general body of the UN because it's a contested election. These are the various items that come in. So what's the disposition at the UN now? Israel spent several years at that particular time of 1990s. Likud was still smarting and being even more stupid than now. And basically, it joined everybody in dissing the United Nations. And you have to remember that this anti-UN stuff with the black helicopters, it was something that was, you know, it's automatic that American isolationists oppose the UN. One of the reasons that this came was the Israel lobby that decided to start cutting back on dues to the United Nations, cutting back on an international treaty obligation to punish them for supporting the Palestinian rights. And once that gap in the dike was opened, the flood came through. And we got to the position where, the UN was on the verge of being defunded by the United States, where UNRWA was defunded, where UNESCO was defunded. This is all a consequence of the Israel lobby interfering to get its own way on particular issues. You know, you think pulling down the whole apparatus of international law because UNESCO has accepted the state of Palestine as accepted by the majority of members is a bit much. But then, we're talking about people who have a hero as Samson who pulled the temple down on top of everybody, regardless of who they were and when they were. So I suppose it's the same thing with them. But the temple is still there, and they're still negotiating there. And now they are actually very active in there. They've always been active. And we've talked about the lobby, and Walter Hickson and others were discussing the means of it. It's a sort of... it's not a coherent, in lockstep body. It's an ecological subsystem of lobbies. Each of these lobbies is, think of the NRA. The NRA that has two purposes in life. One is to provide its staff and its director with a very affluent lifestyle. And the second is to get what it wants on the Second Amendment. a lot of these lobbies are the same. They are competing. So they're competing for the votes of people who hate the United Nations. They're competing for votes of the ones who support Israel tooth and nail and will go to whatever lengths to do so. And they're there all of the time. They take their donors to the United Nations. They introduce them to the Secretary General. They introduce them to the ambassador of major powers, because that's what the donors want. The donors don't just do it because they're nice people. They do it because they get pride in their community. They get medals, they get awards, they get banquets. They get told, you know, the American Jewish Committee will give them a dinner. The Conference of Presidents of Major Organizations will give them an award. And they get taken to the high places of the world and shown it by the lobbyists. It's a very successful operation. And they go to the different countries. They go and bang on the doors of all the hovering nations and say, look, we're really supporting you. And these countries, often weak, fragile, will look and think, wow, major support from the US. These people control Congress. Of course we've got to. It's almost as though they've operationalized the Protocols of Zion. They've persuaded these people that the Protocols of Zion apply and that the Israel lobby completely controls the US Congress and the world. And if they want to get ahead, they have to do it. And it works over and over. You look at Kosovo. Kosovo got a lot of support from Muslim countries at one point in its independence and from others. They got support from Malaya, for example, in a big way. They and the Bosnians all disappeared. You want to be in with the Americans, you have to go and recognize Israel and go to change your embassy. This is the pattern. The more recently, the cleverer Israeli ambassadors have come along. Why did they come to the US? Well, for a start, they're often political rivals. The previous ambassador was someone who was a rival to Netanyahu. By being in New York, you get access to this lobby. You get access to lots and lots of contributions for your own political career back in Israel, which is what they did. And you do this by taking them to see the Secretary General. You take them to see the British ambassador. You take them to see the French ambassador. You take them all along to all of these places. And you get a double butt plus because they push. You're showing the British and the French that if you truckle with us, you're in trouble, because we've got this huge influential sector of American society that's going to weigh against you. And they all want to be on the side of the winners in Washington. They're all being nice. We mentioned Boris Johnson before. Boris Johnson has disappeared up his own fundament, ripping up years of international law as expressed by Britain. And incidentally, Tony Blair began the process. We often forget Margaret Thatcher stood for international law in most cases. She actually voted along with the others on all the Palestinian resolutions against the United States, against Dear Ronald. She voted against it because that was the international law. It took Tony Blair under the influence of Washington to go differently, which is where it's going now. So all these things have consequences. And one of the things that we need to do is to look on how to do it. And it's a war of attrition on 1,000 fronts all the way along. It's minor stuff. It's not minor stuff. You really have to look for it. I've recently raised a fuss because some of you saw in the newspapers that the oldest basket in the world found in Israel. It wasn't. It was found in the occupied territories. Why should I raise that? Where's the Palestinian lobby? What's the Palestinian mission do? Why aren't they saying, hey, that's looting. It's only a basket, but it's our basket. It's a Palestinian basket. You can't claim it as Israeli. It's a war crime to steal cultural practices like this. There's not enough people watching this. The Israelis, on the other hand, the first dereliction and you will get a host of letters. Your editors will get a host of letters. In 1983, I did a tour of the West Bank and the occupied territories. I wrote an article about it for the Guardian, which was rather, it was a bit far out at the time, and the editor was a bit dubious about taking it. And then the letters started coming in. And it just so happened I knew the guy who did this. He was a Jewish friend of mine, in a personal friend, not a political friend by any means, and he coordinated the response. all of his list got a postcard saying, complain to the Guardian about the anti-Semitism in this article. So they all duly put in the letters complaining about anti-Semitism. But they didn't know what they were complaining about. One of them said that because I said there were mosquitoes in Jerusalem, I was clearly anti-Semitic. He'd been told you have to make a complaint. And he was looking at it, well, you know, mosquitoes? Jerusalem? What type of rabid Nazi is this guy? I mean, this is what they were reduced to. But they were doing it. And editors don't like getting complaints. They don't emails now, of course. None of this postcard and licking a stamp and putting it on. They continually on the lookout. And that is what the Palestinians are lacking. They want a host of people because we take it for granted. We think that's silly. You know, why would you complain about something? Why would you complain about a basket in the West Bank? Well, you complain because every time that goes in, it's this incremental war of attrition, depriving the Palestinian claim of legitimacy. And it's that level that goes on at the UN as well. And it's underfunded, understaffed, and it's constrained because Abbas wants everyone to make nice to the Americans and not to upset the Israelis too much. But you really need an aggressive campaign. And I'm afraid at the UN at the moment, it's far worse because the Palestinians supporters for many years, I think Walter Hickson and others referred to this, the worst enemies of the Palestinians were their best friends. You really do not want, or didn't want at the time, Syria and Iraq and Nicaragua under Maduro and Venezuela under Maduro. You really didn't want some of the worst regimes in the country standing up and shouting about Palestinian rights, because they weren't concerned about rights, anybody's rights, as we know. I mean, what they know about human rights could be written on the thin edge of a postage stamp. And everybody else knew that. So it delegitimized it. And what we have to do at the United Nations is to work and get, you know, more acceptable, legitimate countries. We need to get the Europeans and the Scandinavians and South Africa we've got on side, other countries with some credibility on these issues. But unfortunately, they've gone by the wayside, and the Israelis have been working on them as well. Israel has been toading up to India. It's been selling weapons to China. it's using its state influence all the way. So then it comes the question, why is the UN important? I noticed one of the questions that was asked there. What's the effect of the International Criminal Court? Well, the Israelis are very concerned about it. As it is at the moment, they know that every time one of their officials gets on a plane, they stand the risk of arrest when they get off at the other side under universal jurisdiction. If arrest warrant goes out under the ICC, they go there. It's already happened. Israeli officials have landed in London and somebody tipped off, the British police came and tipped them off. If they get off the plane, there's an arrest warrant for them. So, you know, it's a small incremental thing, but I do think it's one of the sort of unsung triumphs of the United Nations that Israeli bureaucrats and military officers have to consult their lawyers and their travel agents before they go anywhere. This is a good thing. And if the type of harassment and delegitimization of what they're doing that has effect, the same way it did with South Africa. And I also have to say to Dugard, we did campaign about South Africa. I was expelled from university over apartheid in South Africa, so I have form on this one. And, there were quite a lot of us paid a price for supporting South Africa. And some of us came into the support for the Palestinians when we saw the Israeli support for South Africa as well, which delegitimized our original sort of social democrat pro-Zionist inclinations. So we were, it was there. We fought against it. And they're still fighting against it. But then you look at the examples. I think that Jeremy Corbyn's big fault, not that he was anti-Semitic, but once he'd accepted the legitimacy of these accusations against some of his colleagues, he opened the dike. The torrent came rushing through. Jeremy Corbyn's a long-standing acquaintance of mine. He hasn't got an anti-Semitic bone in his body. And that's the weapon they used. The accusation is terrifying. It's an internal accusation. It's like in 1984, where not believing in Big Brother sufficiently makes you feel guilty. because you're not along with everybody else. And this is the real weapon of anti-Semitism at the United Nations and on an individual level. Well-meaning people are horrified at being thought anti-Semitic. You know, after the Holocaust, we have every right to be horrified at the thought of the accusation. But on the other hand, we have every right to turn around and rebut and refute those accusations when they clearly are nonsense. And when Ken Livingstone, the former mayor of London, was accused of anti-Semitism, Corbyn and his friends threw him under the bus. That meant that they were next. The bus was coming back for them immediately afterwards, and it came back for them. So part of it is the idea of standing up, like our colleagues earlier today, having the courage to stand up and hold to your principles and getting enough people to do it. There is safety in numbers. If you can get more people to do it, if more editors actually defied the lobby and did it, if they could actually get into their clubs and cabal together and say, look, you know, this report, we should put it out. Netanyahu is a thug. We should say so and get everybody else to say so as well. Or if I say it, will you say it? But those networks have to be built. It's difficult. And part of this conference is an attempt to point the ways to that exercise and how to work on an international level. We should be lobbying delegations at the UN. We should be lobbying the Germans. We should be lobbying the Dutch. We should be lobbying the Scandinavians, all the ones who are wobbly. We should certainly be lobbying Canada. We should certainly be lobbying Australia, because they got a free pass. They have both regressed in a shocking way under US influence. Canada's lost its Security Council seat. Most Canadians don't know that Canada lost its Security Council seat for the last two attempts it tried to, because it had stopped supporting Palestine and was supporting Israeli resolutions. And, you know, the delegates out there, they're marking their card. This is a secret ballot. They couldn't hit back at the US, they couldn't back out at Israel, but they could hit back at Canada, and they did. And Australia has been getting the same treatment over the years. The UK is getting the same treatment for this and Iraq, of course. It's lost several important positions that it used to take for granted on the International Criminal Court and others. But we have to encourage them. You have to build that apparatus. You have to get out there, and individuals have to take action. Not just on baskets in the West Bank, but on basket cases in various capitals around the world. We should go for them and remind them, you know, there are embassies here and they do listen to what people say. If we go lobbying to the British embassy and say, hey, you know, we've seen you. If you protest outside the British embassy, if you have a picket, it has an effect. If you picket outside the German embassy and say, you are an accomplice in war crimes by covering for Israel, that hits them home. And the German press might even cover it, even though they've got their own problems. But we can't let them get away with all of this. United Nations is a flawed instrument, but it is the only instrument we've got. And as I often say, and I think I said in the book, it's like democracy. It's the worst possible, most inefficient thing in the world, but it's the only one we've got, and we have to work with it. And it's something that the Palestinians have been using in a very serious way. They have been, it was actually Yasser Arafat's nephew, Nasser al-Kidwa, who started the long litigational road against Israel, which they are terrified of. Their reaction to BDS is part of that. He pioneered resolution after resolution, which stitched up Israel legally. And our previous speakers are much better on this, but those whole series of resolutions, which were framed to say what Israel is doing, how it contravenes international law, how it contravenes international conventions, why support of Israel is contravention and a form of accomplice and conspiracy with Israel to defy international law. He's done that, but it's up to the rest of us. It's up to the rest of us now to implement it, because you have a law that's not implemented, you may as well not have it. In fact, it brings the law into disrepute as well, just as US support for Israel, unconditional support, has continually degraded the stature of the United Nations and international law. Now, Biden He has shown several signs that he's walked back. There's some funding restored for UNRWA. There's some of the other more outrageous resolutions which have been of executive decisions have been walked back. What does he need to do? He needs to say very firmly that by international law and previous US decisions, the settlements are illegal and Israeli activities there are illegal and in violation of the Geneva Conventions. Let's hear him say it. Then I'm convinced there might be a new era. Up till then, it's like a sumo wrestling match and the Israel lobby is bigger than us and is heaving us out the dojo. So up till then, I don't think Joe Biden really cut to be a sumo wrestler, but who knows? He's surprised me with several of his decisions so far. We've got some hope. So happy to entertain questions, and I'd love to hear the contributions from our international lawyers and others who have been there and been part of this apparatus inside the United Nations of using its facilities to highlight international law and to highlight crimes against international law.
You have been listening to journalist Ian Williams speaking at a forum sponsored by The Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. And that is it for this week. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you'll get involved with the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We will talk again next week.